chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass makes heaven the middle of it. Grass makes heaven the middle. We are grass makes heaven.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got quite a program going today, and we're going to be covering not only the COVID-19 crisis, but we're going to be getting into other aspects of what's really going on a geopolitical basis. Has the Western money powers and the Anglo-American power block turned their back and wants to decouple from China? But what is really going on and the behind the scenes, what's happening? First, I'm going to play a small clip of an Australian 60 Minutes episode. And they're interviewing a Chinese spy. He's telling somewhat what he did during the Hong Kong protest movement there in Hong Kong. And it's very, very interesting, but it gives us an idea of really what the Red Chinese are all about. So here we go with that clip.
It's probably a safe bet that the all-powerful Chinese President Xi Jinping is not a regular viewer of 60 Minutes. But he'll certainly want to see this story. And that's because, from his point of view, it's all about the unthinkable. A Chinese spy, one of his own people, is betraying him, breaking ranks and defecting to the West. Australia, to be more specific. Tonight, China's dirty secrets will be revealed by a very brave man, who's now placed a very big target on himself. And be in no doubt, what Wang Liqiang is doing is so dangerous, speaking publicly is probably the only way to save his life.
Hi Nick, are you around? We have something you might be interested in. An informant came to see us in relation to wanting to expose how the Chinese spy network works around the world.
As an investigative reporter, there are very few times I've received a message this important. It's late October, and one of my sources tells me a spy for the Chinese Communist Party wants to blow his cover.
Today, this guy was actually being followed. He realised that if he doesn't expose this soon, his life might be in danger.
I arranged to meet him in an airport hotel in Sydney. And what Wang William Liqiang reveals is stunning and unprecedented.
Are you scared in speaking out?
To tell the truth, inside of me, I am extremely frightened.
This is a confession like no other. Never before has a Chinese spy gone public in this way. In From the Cold, our insider admits personal involvement in a series of Chinese espionage missions. In Hong Kong, violence and kidnappings aimed at disrupting the democracy movement. And in Taiwan, a master plan to bring down the president.
What risk is he taking in speaking out and going public?
Death. Death not just for him, but for his whole family.
The fate of Wang Lichang and his young family now rests with the Australian government. He's told them Chinese spies are operating here with impunity. And tonight we corroborate his claims by exposing the operation to place an agent in our parliament.
It was like something out of a spy novel. This isn't just cash in a bag, given for favours. This is a state-sponsored attempt to infiltrate our parliament, and Australians should be very, very concerned about this.
Wang William Lichang has painted for as long as he can remember. He loves the feeling of freedom and self-expression it brings him. And yet, these are the very privileges he's devoted his adult life to destroying by working as a spy.
Were you working as a Chinese intelligence officer?
Yes.
At 27, Wang's fresh-faced appearance belies a disturbing reality. For years, he says he's performed undercover espionage operations on behalf of the Chinese government.
None of my family members knew until I came to Australia and applied for a protection visa.
Wang says his life as a spy began when he was enlisted to work for a so-called investment company based in Hong Kong. But it was actually a front for Chinese government spy agencies. And he alleges his boss, Xiang Xin, was a high-ranking military official.
He was trying to recruit me as a core member.
He took you into his trust.
Yes. To be honest, as a Chinese national, this was attractive.
As in, it's attractive to be a spy.
At that time, the word spy didn't cross our mind. We just thought that those things were the tasks we need to do for the country.
One of Wang's first missions in Hong Kong was to sabotage the city's independence movement. For months now, the streets here have resembled a battle zone, with rolling protests and escalating violence. But the fight for control of Hong Kong has really been going on for much longer. For the first time, Wang reveals Beijing's secret strategies.
This is something I really want to let the public know. I know very well the way they operate.
To achieve his mission, Wang was ordered to infiltrate universities, to convert students away from democracy movements and into the arms of the Chinese Communist Party.
We sent some mainland students to join the Students' Association, and they pretended to support Hong Kong independence. They found out information about those pro-independence activists, then we attacked them verbally and made public all their personal data, as well as the data of their parents and family members. In such a way, it effectively silenced them.
Did you instruct people to gather intelligence or information about dissidents, students, democracy activists?
They didn't necessarily know that they were spying. The students in Australia and the other countries were not even aware that the so-called information collecting was espionage.
It's not something he's proud of, but Wang says many of the students he influenced are now involved in the violent clashes with pro-democracy students, as we've seen again this week.
I influence them with patriotism, guiding them to love the country, love the party and our leaders, and fight back strongly against those independence and democracy activists in Hong Kong.
Could Wong ever come back here to Hong Kong?
No, he can't. He just can't do it. For him to survive,
to stay alive,
he can't come back here.
Philip Gregory has spent years trying to expose Chinese spies. He says Wang's revelations about Beijing's activities in Hong Kong will ignite tensions. How rare is it that he's doing what he's doing?
This is once in a lifetime kind of situation. The fact that he's risked so much and that he's so articulate about what he's doing, the fact that he can name names, this is incredible. You can have a rumour, but if you name names, it's a different story.
It's not just universities where Wang's spy operation worked its influence.
Many Western media outlets and politicians describe such activities as peaceful protests.
His extraordinary claim is that his boss infiltrated local media from inside major Hong Kong television networks. Does that have a ring of authenticity to it?
Absolutely. I mean, controlling the message is what it's all about. You know, the idea is to get the message right to the people that need to know it. And in China, that's the party's message.
As a specialist in counter-espionage, Philip Gregory has watched our interview with Wang and scrutinised his claims.
What are your impressions?
A young man full of incredible torment. A brave man. Someone who's really believes what he's saying.
You call him brave. How brave?
Incredibly brave. To a point that the only thing that I think sustains this man is his strong belief in what he's doing, and in particular on freedom for himself and for his children.
What would happen to you if you went back to China?
思想 一个间谍的背叛组织.
Imagine the consequence of a spy betraying the organization. I know very well that the Chinese Communist Party can never be trusted. Once I go back, I will be dead.
This spy that's in Australia now says that, you know, the Communist Party, the Chinese Communist Party can never be trusted, is what he says. He was a spy operating, you know, many of their covert operations. And he related more of what he was doing in Hong Kong was disrupting and planning all kinds of ideas and so forth. But coming up next is a couple of speeches given at the Oxford Union just at the end of March of this year, 2020. And Dr. Pillsbury, Michael Pillsbury, will be the one up first here and at the Oxford Union, and then followed by Anastasia Lin. And she puts the facts out about how the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist government, has mistreated their people. So first, we have Dr. Michael Pillsbury. Here we go now.
With that, I now look to Dr. Michael Pillsbury to close the case for the proposition.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I hope you don't change your mind after 10 minutes. I agree with Mike here, the other Mike, that this is a debate about semantics. And the reason you should vote for us and walk through the right-hand door over there is that we have the better case about China. The issue that I want to compliment the lady here, I don't know your name, I'm sorry, but the question about, you know, what's this come down to, this Cold War versus getting a little bit tougher on China. What President Trump's been doing began with President Obama, and actually you were there. President Obama decided in a number of areas, almost using the same words that President Trump did a couple of days ago, enough from China. So he indicted 5 Chinese military hackers and put their photos up online and talked about the unit that they were doing. They were hacking into our nuclear reactor company in Pittsburgh to get a better market advantage to sell probably 100 nuclear reactors over the next few years. He drew a line in some sense in the South China Sea and began, after a break for a few years, he began having our Navy conduct freedom of navigation operations, but in a tactful way that President Trump has continued. These ships do not go in and circle and go at night, turn on their weapons radar, or launch helicopters. If you do any of those 5 things inside Chinese waters, they could consider it an act of war. So President Obama didn't do it. President Trump doesn't do it. In the trade issue, President Obama pioneered the way, but beginning to raise a lot of issues in the so-called TPP agreement that would focus on environment, labor, many other things. What President Trump took from that was that more pressure was needed. So when I hear you use the word semantics, which is correct, and for you to raise the issue, what really is at stake here between the two teams? To me, new Cold War is a trick. It's a Chinese term. Whenever we or other countries too try to bring pressure on China of any kind, this is what they say. You are screwing around with Cold War mentality. Cold War mentality to the Chinese is anybody who puts pressure on them. It's that simple. Both Anastasia and Anna said, I think correctly, China thinks the Cold War by the West began a long time ago. There are different years. One military film I love called Silent Contest in 2013 said the West is even using rock and roll music to overthrow the Chinese Communist Party. Other authors in my book, I try to take this back. When did this demonization of the West begin? You know who they say was the first real Cold Warrior against China? Abraham Lincoln. So they would laugh at us having a debate here whether we should start a new Cold War. Hey, it's 150 years of containment by you Westerners. Now, what's really at issue is the degree of pressure to ratchet up on China. We know business as usual doesn't work. If you want to endorse business as usual, walk out the left side. If you want more pressure on China to get results, you've got to walk out our side. Let me give you some examples. All kinds of comments about tariffs will never work. The Chinese were laughing, saying, yes, yes, tariffs will never work. They wouldn't come to the negotiating table. The first tariffs were put on. They showed up. Not much progress. They reneged on roughly half the agreement. Pressure went up another notch. A lot more tariffs. Guess what happened? A beautiful, what President Trump calls beautiful, trade agreement suddenly emerged from China, in which they promised no more intellectual theft, property theft, no more technology coercion, long list. The thing is 96 pages long. The Chinese version is pretty accurate, actually. What caused that? Pressure. So to me, and by the way, I'm a Cold Warrior. You can get a medal for being in the Cold War. I actually got it. I was head of policy planning in the Pentagon in the middle of the Cold War under President Reagan. And yes, there were some scary moments. And the Kennedy people would tell us even earlier in 62, you think it's scary now under Reagan, look what happened. We almost had basically nuclear winter and the elimination of all life on Earth, except Herman Kahn said a few men and women will be underground and they will populate the Earth again, in the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62. So the Cold War was scary, it was dangerous, It was 50 years. It's not a good model for what to do with China for the next 50 years. But to vote against us means you want business as usual. And what that really means is Chinese, what shall we say? They like the word ba. Chinese domination of technology innovation, human rights issues, global governance, the redefinition of the values of the West, religious oppression, a rather long list that I think both sides agree on Chinese misconduct. The issue is what to do about it. So, new Cold War that leads to the extermination of all life on Earth. Anybody for that? I don't think so. But new Cold War with a little bit more pressure. Why is that important? And Anna mentioned this. Chinese Communist Party next year celebrates its 100th anniversary. I don't plan to go. Maybe some of you do. If you're a Communist Party member in China, there's 92 million of them, by the way, you've got to learn the history of the party. The history of the Communist Party of China is a struggle between reformers and hardliners. They often kill each other at the very top. President of China kills Vice President of China. House arrest for the Communist Party leader at the time of Tiananmen. House arrest for the rest of his life. Wouldn't it be interesting to know what these debates are about? The West is involved in them, sometimes directly. What to do about the West is what they fight about. So without using the word New Cold War, which is very provocative, it's insulting. It, by the way, in the old bad Soviet-American Cold War, no American leader ever said to a Russian, "We're in a Cold War with you." We had detente, we had summits, we had arms control agreements, we had some limited trade, but it wasn't the end of the world to have strategic tension and rivalry. So what President Trump's been trying to do, he's increased the amount of military exchange programs between us and the Chinese. Is that a bad thing? Is that a new Cold War? The Chinese say it is. They see these American officers are going to interact with our officers and turn them against the Communist Party. Our embassy in Beijing, largest staff in the world, 2,300 people, officials working on China. 50 U.S. government agencies are in China now, each one helping some counterpart in China. Is this a new Cold War? The Chinese say yes. These programs are designed to subvert us. So, to me, new Cold War means we increase these programs. President Trump has a phone call once a month, at least, with his friend Xi Jinping, up to an hour. There was this kind of dialogue also in the Cold War. Reagan wrote letters to Brezhnev, and you know what happened? He answered them. So the end of the old bad Cold War was what? The reformers in Russia took control. Gorbachev, and then even better, Yeltsin, won and changed that whole system. They even put the Soviet Communist Party on trial in Moscow. For China, our help from the outside, without calling it a new Cold War, will help the reformers in China win. And that's the kind of China we want. President Trump wrote about this in a book several years ago, and I'll close with this. He called it, there's a good China and a bad China. And we want the good China.
That was Dr. Michael Pillsbury speaking at the end of March 2020. To a Oxford Union group. Coming up next is Anastasia Lin, and she's got personal experience. In fact, she said in there her grandparents can't leave China or banned from traveling outside of China. So she lays out some very, very detailed things as what's wrong with the communist China. She said there's nothing wrong with the Chinese people. It's the Chinese communist government that she differs with quite a lot. So here we go with Anastasia.
I look to Anastasia Lin to continue the case for the proposition.
Thank you, Madam President. Thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this very important debate. I'm speaking today for the motion that this House will support a Cold War with China, but communist China, not China itself. I am not anti-China. I love my people, and I love China. When I left China when I was 13 years old to Canada, I continued my exploration in the culture's great literature, philosophy. And I know that by heart, the China's philosophical and cultural tradition does not necessarily set it against Western values. In fact, it is entirely possible for a strong and prosperous China to coexist with the West. Look at Taiwan, or look to history. For centuries, China embraced the Confucian outlook and was mostly an inward-oriented empire. If anything, in the 19th century, it was the West, the colonial powers, along with Japan and Russia, that posed a major threat to China, not the other way around. But today's China is different. We're now dealing with a one-party authoritarian, mercantilist state that is openly hostile to Western value and the international system. In considering China's threat, communist China's threat, there are many angles we could explore. We could talk about China's economic warfare, how its state-sanctioned intellectual property theft has cost Western nations trillions of dollars annually, or its exploitation of the WTO. We could talk about China's cyber warfare. UK just signed a deal supporting Huawei to be a leading role in its 5G network building. That's like inviting a Trojan horse. We could talk about China's military buildup. Its aggression in the South China Sea not only threatens regional peace and open trade, but undermines the international law that preserves openness and order. We could talk about China's support to North Korea or Iran, or how it hijacks the Human Rights Council in the UN, or its support for undemocratic and kleptocratic states in Africa, or how it exports its surveillance technology to help other nations crack down on dissent. We could talk about its lax regulatory system brings dangerous exports to our shores, or its censorship of information endangers global health. Now the coronavirus outbreak is a perfect example. Or I can tell you personally how the Chinese government targets family of political dissidents abroad. When I was crowned Miss World Canada in 2015, because I used the platform to speak about China's human rights abuses, my father in China was threatened by the security agents. His business dismantled. Now my grandparents and him are both banned, all banned from traveling outside. I could go on, but for tonight's forum, I'm going to take a novel approach by asking, how does China see us? Does the Chinese Communist Party already consider itself to be in a Cold War with the West? As a child in China, I remember being indoctrinated with the propaganda of the hostile foreign forces. We were repeatedly told that the Western power subjugated and humiliated China in the 19th century, and these old grievances were kept alive to divert domestic discontent. We were told over and over again that even today the West continued to covertly undermine, isolate, destabilize the country. Any expression of discontent within China, including the protests of Tibetan Buddhists, Falun Gong practitioners, democracy activists, are all blamed to the black hand of anti-China forces in the West. Chinese courageous human rights lawyers are being called agents of foreign hostile forces. The pattern continues today. The Chinese government claim that the West is behind Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement and the Taiwanese government. Essentially, all domestic problems are blamed onto the invisible enemy of the West. Let's look at some recent developments in China to see what that can tell us about this country's motive. In 2017, China banned foreign NGOs from operating within the country. unless they submit to government control. Even environmental groups and women's health groups have to have their annual report and their annual plans being approved by the police. The Chinese government claimed that this is to ensure that these NGOs do not subvert the country. Now, why would the Chinese government worry that these foreign NGOs would do anything harmful to China? Perhaps because the Chinese control groups are doing exactly this in our countries. Beijing-backed numerous front organizations, civil societies in Western society. These groups act as an extension to the party and state apparatus. They're oftentimes mobilized to influence local election results or policies in the West. These groups are controlled directly by the United Front Department and the Office of Overseas Chinese. But these connections are often concealed from the public. Now let's look at another example. In 2016, Chinese government banned the talk of democracy, universal human rights, rule of law in Chinese classrooms and curriculum. That is a clear signal that the Chinese Communist Party sees the Western value as a threat to its ideology and its view on the importance of indoctrinating its youth on the right political view. While Western ideas are not allowed into Chinese classrooms, Western universities have ceded control of their own program to the Communist Party through Confucius Institute. The Confucius Institute presents itself as a non-profit language program, but is actually directly controlled by the Communist Party, including its propaganda ministry. A senior communist official has said that the Confucius Institute is an important part of China's overseas propaganda effort. Yet these institutes are embedded in hundreds of universities in the West, raising troubling questions on academic freedom and freedom of expression on university campuses. The story is similar in entertainment and media area. China obsessively censors the internet. It only allows a small number of foreign film into the country each year, carefully screened, carefully edited. Even children's animated film like Zootopia is attacked as Western propaganda. Now, the situation in the West is vastly different. New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Telegraph, these papers all run paid news supplements from China Daily, a communist mouthpiece. Companies with deep ties with the Chinese Communist Party are now buying or entering joint ventures with major Hollywood studios, creating strong financial incentive for self-censorship. Chinese companies already own some of the biggest movie theater chains in the West. Now this, they get to control what the Western audience get to see or not to see, what is getting to produce, what not. It's increasingly unlikely that we will see a film that is produced about the Cultural Revolution, the Tiananmen Massacre, Tibetan Falun Gong, or Uyghurs in the Hollywood. Now, one may say that our democratic and open Western values are more resilient than Chinese brutal authoritarianism. I wish that were true, but it isn't. Lured by self-interest, our institutions are proven all too willing to give up human rights and free speech. Western companies know that their technology are helping the Chinese government to surveil its own system through an infamous social credit system. Yet they still deal with them. We all know that Huawei's 5G technology is a Trojan horse that will affect our future, our children's future. But yet, we just signed a deal with them. Our values are already compromised. Our way of life is already conceded. But let me remind you that the human rights atrocities, the injustice that are happening within Chinese border cannot be contained. It will bleed out to every silent bystander in the world. And the coronavirus outbreak is a perfect example of that. On December 1st, Chinese government has already discovered the first case of coronavirus in Wuhan. Yet the local officials spent the first period of time suppressing the news, arrested 8 courageous doctors for, quote, spreading rumor and destabilize the society. The local government even went as far as hosting 100,000 people to a public Chinese New Year dinner just to show that Wuhan is as prosperous as ever and as safe as ever. This is reminiscent of what happened in Chernobyl. The Soviets did not admit the nuclear accident until Sweden had picked up its fallout and threatened to report it to International Atomic Energy Agency. The Chinese government did not reveal the virus and report it about or confirm the virus outbreak until the first overseas case was detected in Thailand. One may ask, why did the Chinese officials take such a risk? The mentality of Chinese communist officials is that they are willing to gamble on human life in the sake of their own rule. And this mentality is the same from the smallest town to the central government in Beijing. The sole purpose for Chinese Communist Party is to stay in power, disregarding the cost of human life. There are many doctors, courageous doctors and nurses, using different channels to try to tell the world the truth about the outbreak. They reported that the hospitals are over capacity. Doctors and nurses are infected. Many people are turned away to self-quarantine at home. Many people are dying. The life under authoritarian Chinese Communist Party is a life without God's grace. It's a life where your innate worth as a human being is never recognized and your value is judged solely on your use for the Chinese Communist Party. And that was my childhood. I want to close by reminding everyone that supporting a Cold War with Communist China, you're standing with the Chinese people. By confronting a regime that's brought turmoil and suffering onto this ancient land for decades. I also want to leave you with this question. If the Chinese Communist government does not treat its own citizens with any respect, why should us in the West expect ourselves to be treated any differently? Thank you.
The question has been arising as to, we know China has become a real threat to the world. So is the question then, there was a recent article at Atlantic magazine, and they were touting this thing and they were putting down anyone that proposing a decoupling from China. But what I see going on behind the scenes is that the Western powers, the financial money powers, the Anglo-American, you could say money power group, is taking a second look at China and saying, hey, China, you've been stealing our trade secrets, our patents, and then running our own companies out of China and not even giving back their capital. So, hey, what's up here, China? And China is out to dominate the world. That's basically what they're all about. So we all of a sudden, we have this virus thing that all of a sudden it pops up on us. Now, Fauci 3 years ago made a speech and predicted there might be a surprise virus pandemic. Here's he speaking 3 years ago, Dr. Fauci.
My name's Alan Weil. I'm editor-in-chief of Health Affairs. We're very pleased to be a partner in this event. I want to add my thanks to you all for being here and particularly my appreciation to Ashish and John for the collegial way we've put this together. We each bring great strengths to this topic, and I think together we do something none of us could do individually, and I want to echo Ashish's comment at the beginning that we hope this is the beginning of more even if we have to leave the rarefied air of Washington, D.C. and Cambridge, Massachusetts to do so. It is truly my honor to be able to introduce our keynote speaker today. It is often said, just look at the bio. There's so much there, and indeed there is, but I think it's important that you understand, if you don't already, the great credibility and accomplishments of our speaker today, Tony Fauci, who's director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. As you'll hear in his remarks, he served under five presidents, which I think is quite relevant to the conversation we've been having already this morning. He was one of the principal architects of the creation of PEPFAR. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences, the National Academy of Medicine, many awards, including the National Medal of Science and the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Dr. Fauci has 43 honorary doctoral degrees, author, editor of more than 1,290 scientific publications. He brings experience and credibility and perspective. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Fauci. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. I've spoken at after-dinner speeches and intra-dinner speeches, but I've never spoken to a line of people waiting to get their food. So it's nice to have you. Anyway, it's the idea that we are now a few days away from a new administration obviously prompted the really extraordinarily, very enjoyable, and I'm really pleased I had the opportunity to listen to the panel, both of Amy and Ron, and as well as Bill and Dr. Jafari, which really, I think, set the stage for so many of the things that we are going to be dealing with over the coming years. Given, as you heard from the introduction, that I have been around for a while and have had the opportunity and the privilege and the pleasure of serving in five administrations, I thought I would bring that perspective to the topic today, is the issue of pandemic preparedness. And if there's one message that I want to leave with you today based on my experience, and you'll see that in a moment, is that there is no question that there will be a challenge to the coming administration in the arena of infectious diseases, both chronic infectious diseases in the sense of already ongoing disease, and we have certainly a large burden of that, but also there will be a surprise outbreak. And I hope by the end of my relatively short presentation, you will understand why history, the history of the last 32 years that I've been the director of NIAID, will tell the next administration that there's no doubt in anyone's mind that they will be faced with the challenges that their predecessors were faced with.
This is so eerie. This was 3 years before at a dinner that Dr. Fauci gave, made this prediction of a surprise pandemic. Now, what's going on in this country? Are they telegraphing their moves before they make it, or what? What we're going to discuss a little bit next about this event 201.
Right from Broker Studios, this is Bloomberg Daybreak. I'm Nathan Hager. As the coronavirus outbreak approaches a pandemic, global leaders and health officials are scrambling to contain the fallout that has sparked quarantines and many other emergency actions around the world. It is a scenario that has been planned for, and in one case just months ago, at a gathering of leaders in global finance, policy, and healthcare. Bloomberg's Janet Wu was there and brings us this report.
The date was October 18th. International business, government, and public health leaders gathered at the Pierre Hotel in New York. Their goal that day was to simulate a coordinated response to a hypothetical but scientifically plausible global viral outbreak.
We're at the start of what's looking like it will be a severe pandemic.
Simulated news reports describe a virus that emerged in a small farm in South America that jumped from sick animals to farmers.
It began in healthy-looking pigs. A new coronavirus spread silently within herds.
This simulation is a joint exercise between the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, the World Economic Forum, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
The sickest required intensive care. Many died.
We have to be prepared for all pandemics. And the possibility of a rapidly moving airborne pandemic is one that we really particularly have to get ready for, because it'll probably be in several countries before we even know it.
Chris Elias is president of Global Development for the Gates Foundation. He leads the effort to deliver healthcare products and solutions to those who need them most.
I met Bill Gates not long ago, and he described this before the New England Journal of Medicine as one of his worst nightmares.
What could kill 10 million people today? You know, nuclear war, an asteroid, and a pandemic.
So far, the World Health Organization is stopping short of calling the COVID-19 outbreak a pandemic. The current situation comes close to the technical criteria for the term, a virus that mushrooms across multiple continents. But the WHO says COVID-19 falls short of causing large-scale severe disease or death.
In the 20th century, we had three big pandemics of influenza. The biggest one in 1918 killed more people than both World War I and World War II put together. And 100 years later, we're in an even more interconnected world.
And that's the real fear here. Advances have made the world smaller, and therefore more vulnerable to communicable disease. We're seeing international travel spread this new coronavirus from China to other countries in Asia, Europe, the Middle East, and North and South America. That concern is what prompted this 3.5-hour exercise back in October to put a spotlight on important gaps in preparation for a pandemic and create solutions to fill those gaps.
It's not easy gathering all of these business executives together in one place to do this, but these games, for lack of a better word, are important.
You know, you can write and read about the best practices, but when you simulate with actual breaking news and alerts coming in, you get people to think what they might do if they really faced it. It's really thinking through, how would we manage our supply chain? How would we communicate across regions about this outbreak?
That's what brought the business and policy leaders to the Pierre Hotel more than 4 months ago to simulate a response to a fictitious global health crisis. As the morning progressed, the scenario turned stark.
We could be looking at double the number of cases in 1 week and 16 times as many in a month. In 3 months, we could be approaching 10 million cases.
In this simulation, the virus spreads from South America to North America, then to Europe, as passengers board planes unaware they're infected.
International travel has turned local epidemics into a pandemic.
Participants in this exercise include Martin Knuschel, head of crisis and emergency management for the German airline group Lufthansa.
That's the risk we are facing, and we are aware of this. We will be the first one to hit it, and we will spread it around.
Also taking part in this simulation, Latoya Abbott, crisis and occupational health director for Marriott International.
It would be one of our worst nightmares, but one thing about Marriott, we are very into and on top of business continuity, making sure our crisis plans are always together.
She's joined by C-suite executives from global companies including UPS, healthcare companies like Johnson & Johnson, lead health officials from China and Nigeria, plus representatives from the United Nations, the Centers for Disease Control, and the World Bank. And of course, the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, which created this scenario. I spoke with Director Tom Inglesby.
These are the kinds of exercises that Bill Gates has called germ games. The idea is for people to try and imagine themselves in the story, to feel the full consequences of it, to get experiential learning. That's the goal.
The World Health Organization responds to roughly 200 epidemics a year. This simulation was dubbed Event 201, named for a hypothetical 201st outbreak that could be the catastrophic one.
We've had some near misses, such as the SARS virus in the early 2000s, which spread to multiple countries around the world with a high case fatality rate. We have viruses in the world that now have a case fatality rate of 50%. They kill 1 in 2 people they infect. So we have to be better prepared, and we have to have global systems in place to be able to take care of people, to ensure travel and trade doesn't collapse, to try and avoid the worst economic consequences.
In this simulated exercise from October, they play out the very worst case scenario.
People are avoiding public spaces out of fear of infection. This has had a dramatic effect. The spread of misinformation via social media is another new risk not seen in earlier 20th century pandemics, and it can have a devastating impact. Ryan Morhard leads Global Health Security for the World Economic Forum.
A large chunk of the economic impact that we see doesn't come from the virus itself. It comes from the way we react to it. And that's actually reason for optimism. There are things that we can do to reduce economic impacts and reduce impact on lives and livelihoods.
Participants in this exercise are asked to respond to the fictitious pandemic in a variety of ways. Business leaders must protect their workforce and manage financial fallout. Government officials must deploy dollars and resources, while health officials support national and international efforts. In this simulation, the outcome turns disastrous.
The outcome of the CAPS pandemic in event 201 was catastrophic. 65 million people died in the first 18 months. Cases were occurring in nearly every country. The global economy was in a free fall. Economists say the economic turmoil caused by such a pandemic will last for years, perhaps a decade. We have to ask, are there things we could have done that would have lessened the catastrophic consequences?
In this exercise from October, and in nearly all cases, the answer is yes, according to the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security Director, Tom Inglesby.
We've had pandemics in the past. We absolutely will have them again. Every global health expert agrees on that. So now is the time to prepare for those.
Most health experts expect a far milder fallout from the current coronavirus. The mortality rate is much lower than the SARS outbreak of 17 years ago, though this virus appears to spread more easily. Still, simulations like this one from late last year and the fight against the current outbreak are a stark reminder of the damage that's possible from a truly global pandemic. I'm Janet Wu, Bloomberg Daybreak.
This last clip was about the event 201 that was held in at Johns Hopkins, at a hotel actually, but Johns Hopkins, World Economic Forum, and then the Bill and Melinda Gates, they collaborated with this also. But what it gives rise to is that what was actually happening now, why would they have an exercise with coronavirus in October, and then all of a sudden, you know, as Fauci said back 3 years ago, this administration is going to experience a surprise virus, and all of a sudden this thing pops up out of nowhere, so to speak. And you know, just a few months after this exercise headed up by all of these world, you could say, eugenics people. So what is this about? There's an important term to focus in on. It's called revelation of the method. And what happens is that inevitably, when we've been tracking these great events, these, you know, historical, hysterical, very, very evil events that have been unfolding, they're telegraphing that particular event ahead of time. So, is the exercise that was just recently in this country, held by these entities that we're talking about, Event 201, was that the revelation of the method to give us a heads up as part of the occult type of mechanism, or what? This is something that we've got to start getting into. So all of my listening audience, go into revelation of the method and dig down in there and read more about that. We're going to have click-offs on all of these clips that we played this evening. And so you'll be able to go in there and dig down in there and listen to the total programs, you know, that we took the clips, the small clips out of. We couldn't present the whole program, but we did as much of that as possible. But this revelation of the method is a method of brainwashing people. You prepare them unconsciously or subconsciously to a future event. And as that event, they're not aware that they're actually being programmed to look for or to anticipate.
One another explanation was it was the, is it that they're marshaling the occultists that are pulling off of some of these events are marshaling all the dark forces together to have a greater impact when the actual event does take place. So that might be another explanation. We know that the Chinese were ill prepared in China and Wuhan and didn't anticipate this as dreadful a virus epidemic or pandemic that did occur. We have about 8 doctors over there that tried to warn the Chinese government about an impending pandemic, or actually be an epidemic. It was just in Wuhan at the time. But the Red Chinese government, being authoritarian, took these warnings as insults or criticism of the system, medical system, or the government, and so forth. So they ignored those warnings trying to be given to the government by really well-respected doctors. So it went ahead and happened, and it was just a dreadful thing that took place, and it shouldn't have, but it did. So here we are sitting now with a virus that's probably 10 times or more dangerous than an annual seasonal flu virus. So this is nothing to mess around with. There are talk show hosts out here that are trying to lay the blame totally on China, saying that they released it. If they had released it, that would have been suicide, in my opinion. So I disagree with those opinions that are being broached out here today about China being behind this. It seems like to me, with this revelation of the method, and I believe that's what happened in October, then the West money powers with the Anglo-American, it was an operation. Don't know exactly who carried this out, but it looks like it's an operation to cut China down to size and to warn them as a warning, you mess around with stealing our patents and our trade secrets and then not giving back our capital when we want to come out of China, then we're gonna come after you. And I think that basically is what happened in this situation. I think China at one point in this epidemic or pandemic in China realized that the West could have possibly launched this attack and started sending perhaps agents. This is all speculation, and this is my opinion. But it's very well possible that they started sending agents to the West to spread that virus even more so, because all of a sudden it appeared everywhere, you know, in the world. And it may, I know the plane flying internationally all over the world could have spread this virus like that, but perhaps there was little agents out here, you know. I'm just speculating now, so I have no proof of making this pure speculation. It's a theory. It's not founded in fact. And I want to make that perfectly clear for our listening audience. But it's very well possible. Let's put it that way. It's plausible. Let's use that word. It's plausible that the Chinese, if they got onto this being a Western attack on them, or a Western, operation, then it's very, very possible that they came back at us with this retaliatory, you could say, attack on us. And that could have very well been the case. I want to thank each and every one of you in our listening audience out there, and dig down into this. Go in there, Revelation of the Method. Go in there and dig down, read all you can on that. Go down there and click off on the click off set I'm going to put up on our site, thesecrettruth.com. But thank you for listening, and good night, and God bless each and every one of you. Good night.